Welcome to the Dad Strength Podcast, helping you earn the mug that says world's greatest dad. My name is Jeff Gervitz. I am your host. I am a dad, and I am thinking about forgiveness as a skill. This is something that I have learned and took me most of my life to do. When I was growing up, I didn't know. I just thought that if someone hurt you enough or offended you enough, you would just cancel them out of your life. That was it. No more conversations. No more anything. And that was just the default mode of operating. So I have learned that it does not have to be that way. And as a parent, as a husband, I think about forgiveness because I need it a lot. And so with my own son, and I do not presume to tell you how to parent here, I'm just going to share something that feels important to me personally, and that is no matter how mad we are, no matter how upset we are, as soon as I can, I always tell him I love him. I always hug him up, and I want him to know that if nothing else, even if I'm furious with him, I still love him. Those two things can absolutely coexist. Now, with other relationships, of course, it can get more complex, and sometimes we have to manage boundaries to protect ourselves, and we're going to get into this. We are going to get into all kinds of things with today's guest. Morgan Campbell is the author of My Fighting Family, Borders and Bloodlines and the Battles That Made Us. He is an award-winning journalist who writes for the New York Times. He is the first senior contributor to CBC Sports, and he was a sports writer at the Toronto Star for over 18 years. His work has been featured in the New York Times, the Literary Review of Canada, and the Best Canadian Sports Writing Anthology. Not too shabby. In another first, he is my first return guest to the podcast because I want to talk about his excellent book with him, and this seems like a pretty good place to do it. Morgan and I met over a decade ago. One of the coaches who worked out of our personal training studio had been coached by Morgan in track and field. When he came in, we hit it off right away. He was incredibly engaging, clearly multi-talented. He's got a viewpoint, as you will hear, and I learned a lot from him. Sometimes he would bring in his girlfriend, now his wife, former Olympian and now TV host Perdita Felicien. Morgan worked out with us for a long time before getting married, packing up and moving to the suburbs. Now he is a dad and a recently published author. Although I want to say he's got us writing programs for him again, which is good. We want to keep him moving forward. The story Morgan tells in his new book is completely different than my own. But there were so many themes that I recognized and felt utterly familiar. And that's the thing about families. There's something universal and human at the center of all of it, including and maybe especially our conflicts. Before we get started, I want to remind you that you can go to dadstrength.com, look for the newsletter, and subscribe. I share weekly thoughts on fatherhood, focus, and fitness distilled from countless conversations with dads. There's a tremendous amount of wisdom in any given household. We have not all figured everything out, but everyone has figured out some things really beautifully. I share this stuff with you so that you can take better care of yourself and be more present for the people in your life. Now for my interview with Morgan Campbell. Let's get into it. So maybe I'll get you to start by explaining the title.
For your audience.
Yes, please.
For the Dad Strength audience. Okay, dads. The book is called My Fighting Family, Borders and Bloodlines and the Battles That Made Us. And so it's a memoir, and it deals with my life growing up Black and American in Canada in a family whose two halves don't get along. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this book is my attempt, you know, to try to make sense of all that conflict. And so My Fighting Family, Borders and Bloodlines and the Battles That Made Us.
So how do you navigate forgiveness in this kind of dynamic?
You can forgive what people did to you, but that's different from understanding somebody's character. Mm-hmm. For the people that haven't read the book, there's five big characters. You know, there's me, obviously, my mom's dad, Claude, my dad's mom, Mary, and then my two parents. And the two people driving the feud are my dad's mom and my mom's dad. They were the ones that grew up together in Chicago, didn't like each other, and then naturally their firstborn each marries the other person's firstborn. So now they are handcuffed together by marriage. But also those two, my mom's dad and my dad's mom, are the most excited to leap with 2 feet into every family fight. And those two in particular are the ones that are concerned with winning, and they'll do whatever it takes to win. So yeah, I could forgive my grandmother for some of the really, really nasty, underhanded things she did to my sisters and my mom and me. I can forgive my mom's dad for the way he acted, the way he treated my mother, the way he treated my father. My mom could forgive her dad for the way he treated her. But that also doesn't mean that, like, after they keep doing this, you can keep forgiving them. But eventually, you see all these incidents, all these fights, and their role in them, not just as incidents, but as part of this person's character. I do forgive you for what you did. But also what you keep doing tells me that's just what your character is. So I just have to deal with you differently.
Yeah, some right. boundaries, some frames so that you can keep loving them. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's not a lack of love, but I'm just not a fool, you know? Very early on, there's a passage where I meet some of my grandparents' neighbors. I'm 24 years old at this point. And they ask me whose kid I was. They said, are you Peggy's son or are you Jeff's son? Now, my grandparents have 4 kids. So I said, I'm Jeannie's son. And the neighbor says to me, well, who is Jeannie? I said, Jeannie is their oldest daughter. And the neighbor says, your grandparents told me they only had 2 kids, Jeff in Toronto and Peggy in Chicago. So I say that because what was happening was my mom had been in a fight with her father a few years before that. And he stopped talking to her and he was so angry with her that he just started telling people he didn't have a daughter, that my mom did not exist. He just would not acknowledge her. If someone's going to do something like that in the name of winning a fight, they can do what they want and you can forgive them for it later. But at the same time, like if that's something you do, then I have to change the way I deal with you. You know, that's how we navigate forgiveness. Like, forgiveness doesn't mean you can just keep kicking me in the teeth every chance you get. And then just because you said, I'm sorry, and I said, I forgive you, you can put the steel toe boot back on and kick me again. And I was like, no.
So who are you as a result of these conflicts? Often emotional, occasionally physical. Not in the family. We'll get into some of the fisticuffs later.
Yeah. What I was learning heading into writing this book, what I definitely learned in the process of writing this book is that, you know, some families, like, we like to fight. You know, so much of the feedback I've gotten from people that have read the book, you know, what I'm hearing is my family's not at all like your family, but my family is exactly like your family in the sense that families have factions. In the sense too that, like, each faction often has a leader, and that leader thinks it's his or her duty to win every fight. And the biggest thing I've learned is that, you know, nobody wins family fights. These family fights cost more than they gain. And if you value relationships, you have to think about what it costs you to win that fight, especially if you're the person that puts winning the fight, you know, above being right in a greater sense and above the teamwork and the unity that we usually associate with the word family.
I wonder if for a lot of people, you know, withholding love, withholding affection, withholding attention is sort of an attempt to create control.
With my mom's dad and my dad's mom, that's exactly what it was. And again, for the people, as you read the story, what might strike you is how deeply those two disliked each other, but how similar they were. In the sense that they liked control, and in the sense that they would cut you on or cut you off, you know, to teach you a lesson. And again, these are two people that professed to hate each other. And I'm sure they really did hate each other. It was not an act, but at the same time, that technique was a go-to technique for each of them.
How has your extended family reacted to the book?
They're still reading through it. It's like, I warned everyone in my family, this is not the book any of you would have written. If my point of view on a given incident is different than yours, that's fine. And like a lot of details you all would have included, I have not included because it's my book. And so when you write a book like this that deals with family and deals honestly with family, you do run the risk of pissing off some of your relatives only because every family has factions, you know. And if, you know, something you write, they perceive as reflecting poorly on the leader of their faction, then it's going to be trouble. But at the same time, like, and I tell people this because people ask me, well, what's it like to write about family? What's the key? Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, you just have to write a story that's true and it's honest. And you're not going to please everyone. But at the same time, like, say a Granny Mary faction came to me and said, we don't like what you wrote about Mary. I would say, but it's all true. It all just depends on the lens through which you read it. My mom has started to read it. My mom is a very harsh critic. So we'll see. Like, she might love the book and then still be like, 2 stars. That's just my mom, you know, because like in another life, my mom, you know, could have been Jemele Hill, Christine Brennan, Sally Jenkins, like a really sharp columnist and commentator on a number of subjects, sports included. Like, you guys should see the emails my mom sends me on Monday mornings talking about football. Mm. Like, you could publish it. You know what I mean? She thinks deep thoughts about the Chicago Bears. And then a few other things. And then politics, obviously.
You get a few actual fight stories, physical fight stories in the book. Oh, yeah, you landing a few sidekicks.
Yes.
But my favorite one involves your mom, who's okay, adorable, yeah, by the way. You sure that one?
Quick background. My mom grew up in an all-white neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. So they were the only black family in this working-class white neighborhood, which is a near statistical impossibility back then, where when white people would literally try to physically bar you from moving in.
Well, they did in this
sort
case,
of.
Right?
So what happens is, but they landed in the neighborhood because my great-grandfather got a job at a lumber yard down in West Pullman, which is far south side of Chicago, a little bit west. Mm-hmm. And the people that owned the lumber yard also owned houses, and they would rent to employees. And they did not discriminate. And so they rented to, you know, my great-grandparents' family. And the neighbors didn't like it, but the guy that owned the lumber yard and kept a lot of the neighbors employed, that's what he wanted. So what are they going to do to their boss, right? And so two different generations of this family wind up as the only black kids at the little local elementary school. And so one afternoon, my mom is walking back. Jeannie Jones, she's about 11 or 12 years old. And she's walking back to school from lunch, and these three white boys fall in behind her and just start taunting her, calling her Hershey bar and calling her tar baby over and over and over again. And like, as they get closer to school, the boys get closer to my mom. They're getting close enough to touch her now. Hershey bar, tar baby, like this. And my mom is like trying to add up what to do. And she's terrified, but she's cagey. But at a certain point, whoever the biggest guy is, the loudest one, he just calls her one tar baby too many. And she just stops. And she clenches her fist and she pivots. And as she turns around, she hits the biggest one right in the jaw. And like, he goes careening sideways. And he bangs his head against this plate glass window that's like at the storefront that's next to the sidewalk. And so the window starts wobbling, and then all three of them are standing there like, whoa, what's going to happen? And then the bullies now, though, they're just frozen, because whatever they thought they were going to be able to do, like, they did not count on this little black girl cold cocking this guy, right? And it was a calculated risk my mom took. But at the same time, this sort of universal lesson about bullies, right, is that you fight back, they're going to back off, because what they don't want is a fight. They just want one-way traffic. Yeah. And when they figured out a counterpunch was coming, it changed the calculus. And so she just turned and headed the rest of the way back to school. Like, they still followed her, but from a really, 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 really safe respectful distance.
Now, exactly. Now your mom in her 70s is tiny and adorable. So yeah. I have to imagine that's a lifelong theme.
Yeah. Well, listen,
back
mom,
even then. Yeah.
My mom will knock you out and go right back to baking cookies. As my mom.
I grew up in a family with its fair share of internal conflicts, more than its fair share. We probably borrowed some from other people. I just remember as a very young person how clear those dividing lines were. And then as I got older, talking with my older brother about it and him saying, look, Jeffrey, in every disagreement, there are two sides and the truth is somewhere in the middle. And that sounded right at the time, but upon reflection, lots of reflection, I came to conclude that the truth isn't always in the middle. It's not a compromise. It's not a bargain. it can be completely different from everyone's perspective. We don't have the gift of an omniscient narrator like we do in a book to give us the objective truth. All we're left with is our own impressions, and often they're so wildly different from each other's that it's tough to make sense of anything. And that led me to my next question. And talk to me about your relationship with your dad.
What do you need to know?
I mean, in describing him, especially through the lens of his relationship with your mom, there's a lot that seems wanting as you go through it. But you also, you know, you lose him at a young age, and, you know, you go through this process, and it felt to me reading it like there was a lot of forgiveness for him, you know, after he passed. That's my take as a reader.
Yeah, my dad was a really, really, really complicated person. It's funny. He did not like to talk. He used words very sparingly. And so my wife, you know, she never met him. He died long before my wife and I met. My wife likes to talk. And one of my wife's barometers for whether or not someone has a personality is basically how much they talk. If you talk a lot, you have a personality, you're outgoing. If you don't talk a lot, you must be meek and shy and timid. And me and my wife and my mom, and we were talking about my dad, and my wife described my dad as meek and timid. And my mom and I were like, where did you get that idea? And my wife was like, well, you said he didn't like to talk. I'm like, yeah, he did not like to talk, but that does not mean he was meek and timid. He was the opposite of meek and timid. He just did not like talking. Those are two very different things, you know? Like boxing fans, you could look at Muhammad Ali. He liked to talk, and Sonny Liston did not like to talk. But was Sonny Liston meek or timid, you know, early career George Foreman? Not at all. He just did not like talking, you know? And so, yeah, he was a really difficult guy. And so, you know, one of the challenges in this book, but it's a necessary challenge if you want to write a truthful memoir. And this is why this memoir worked better for me as someone in my 40s than it would have, you know, if I tried to write it in my 20s, is that you have to be able to see your parents as human beings, fully formed characters, as adults, independent of you, who had lives before you showed up, who had lives of their own even after you showed up. And, you know, a lot of this book was me, you know, making sense of my father as a man. You know, anyone reading the book is going to understand, you know, that I adored and still do. I adored my father. But that doesn't mean I can't talk about his flaws and be honest about his flaws, right? And again, this comes back to how different factions of the family see stuff. Like, if I can be honest about my dad's flaws, I can be honest about your dad's flaws or your mom's flaws. My dad, yeah, he died at 52, metastatic colon cancer. You know, and he died with a lot of regrets in terms of the way, you know, he managed and mismanaged his marriage. He was not a very good husband. I have no complaints about him as a father, but he was also like a, not so much of a role model as a husband, but like an object lesson as a husband. Provide a lot of examples of things not to do, ways not to run your marriage. You know, and one of the regrets for him is that he died, you know, as he started realizing that he was not going to live too much longer. But it was at a point where, you know, my sisters and I were becoming adults, and he was finally starting to be able to relate to us as adults instead of kids. And he never got that chance. And so one of the things, though, that his death when I was 17, like one of the things it taught me is that, one, you're just not always going to get what you want. You're not always going to get what you wish for. You're not always going to get what you think is right or what you think is just, you know, in the grander, like, cosmic sense. But it doesn't mean you have to stop or give up. Even if you have to pause for a while, give yourself room to breathe, you know, to regroup. But it doesn't have to stop you from becoming who you're going to become.
That kind of perspective taking, and I think, you know, for as long as I've known you, it's something that you do. It's something that you add to the conversation, to the dialogue, to your writing. How is that? Like, that's continued into your career. Let's talk about your writing. Where'd you start? What'd you do? How's it going? Like, you came up as a sports reporter?
Yeah, well, sort of indirectly. And I'm not going to rehash my whole 18 years at the Toronto Star. I will say this, though. You know, in the memoir, I do get into how I got into writing, in the sense that I was like a really indifferent student in high school, but certain topics, certain segments of certain classes would catch my interest. So, like, for one unit, I would get an A plus, and then the rest of the class I would just tune back out, you know, and then finish with a B minus, something like that. But, you know, it was around 16 I started reading more. And then by the end of high school, I thought about making writing a career. Really quickly, so I went to Northwestern University, Medill School of Journalism, which the journalism nerds will tell you is a really prestigious journalism school. Went to school with some really smart folks, learned a lot about how to be a journalist and how to be a writer. But I actually could not get any traction in the early part of my career as a sports writer because I was on the football team at Northwestern. And then after 2 years on the football team, I started working different jobs in the athletic department. And so I would not cover sports on campus because it was a clear conflict of interest. And when I graduated and was on my way out of school, my first couple years out of school, and I would try to apply for sports writing jobs, like any number of recruiters told me I would never make it because I didn't have enough clips about sports. And I would explain to them it was because I was playing sports and that experience has to count for something. And they were like, no. The guys you're up against for this job, they've been stringing for the AP since they were 6 years old. They got 4,000 game stories on deadline, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, with some experience in the industry, I figured out that all of that was just gatekeeping because lots of people want to cover sports. And if you were tasked with like hiring sports writers, the first thing you want to do is just shrink the pool of applicants to a manageable size. So you just look for any excuse to tell people no, because in reality, like covering sports is no different from covering anything else. You do have to sort of learn, you know, the lingo, you know, and the details of each sport. Yes. But at the same time, you're just telling stories and you have to find stories, cover stories, uncover stories. It's the same if you're covering courts, if you're covering education, if you're covering sports, it's all the same. And so on the way into sports writing, they treat you like it's some mystical, hard to acquire skill set. And it's really not. You know, you meet people, you get to know people, you develop sources, you figure out questions to ask. That's it. And again, I'd be doing that no matter what I was covering. And so when finally, like when I got to the Toronto Star, I was on an internship program and we were there for a year. And like each of us had to shuttle through different departments throughout the course of the year. And so the sports editor, Steve Tustin, he just said, yeah, come join my department. And I just hit the ground running and there was nothing special or mystical about sports reporting. It was no different from any of the reporting I'd ever done, especially now. Yeah, it helps if you understand sports, that's fine. But even if you come to a sport that you don't really understand, you can write really good stories based on the fact that like a lot of stuff that other people take for granted is brand new to you, you know? And so you do not have to have been like a sports writing specialist forever to get into sports and write some really good stories. So condensed version, you know, I was off and on in the sports department at the Star from 2006. I did a 5-year run at the sports department. And then from 2011 to 2015, I was in the business department. 2015 to 2019, when I left the Star, I was back in sports. And so, yeah, you know, I won some awards and really tried to carve out a lane in the Canadian sports media industry as a guy that could write the on the field stuff, but could also write the beyond the line stuff and really place these sports stories into their proper context in terms of where sports intersects with race, politics, business, etc.
So from a young age, you had this sense that not all the stories you were being told were the real stories. Not all representations were accurate representations. Sometimes there were a lot of errors of omission. And then, you know, you talk about your experiences as a Black American coming up through a Canadian school system. And some of the things that I really kind of grabbed my attention in the book were you describing your feelings, your experiences reading through textbooks. Can you talk about that?
Here I am, this Black kid in a country, in a school system where most of the people are white. I'm also Black American in the school system and in a city where most of the Black people are not American. You know, and I get to high school and in 10th grade history, there was this unit on, you know, early 20th century Canadian like stars who was famous in Canada, what movies were famous, what songs were famous and why. And there's a couple pages in the textbook about the film Birth of a Nation, D.W. Griffith, came out in 1915. And that the film was very popular in Canada. And laid out some of the reasons that this film was popular in Canada, including cinematic techniques, camera angles, flashbacks, etc. What the book was silent on was the plot, the subject matter of Birth of a Nation. But I knew what that movie was about only because my parents used to record in Buffalo. And one of them dealt with how stereotypes about Black people were created and reproduced in mass media, starting with the postbellum South. And so this documentary went into detail on Birth of a Nation and how it was based on a novel called The Klansman. And so the nation being born in this movie was the Ku Klux Klan, who were portrayed as heroes for brutalizing Black people who had gone feral because post-slavery, there was no institution to keep Black people civilized, right? So this is the framework within which Birth of a Nation takes place. Our textbook mentioned nothing about it because mentioning that Canadians packed movie theaters to watch a movie that glorified and glamorized the Ku Klux Klan means interrogating and sort of cross-examining Canadians on their views of race. Why were you people so attracted to this movie that was so blatantly racist, even for its time? And so I wound up bringing up, this was the nerd class. This was in the enhanced learning program at the Woodland School in Mississauga, which you did not qualify for unless you were, you know, a really 98th, 99th percentile standardized test score. So these are smart kids. These are very bright kids. You know, but just none of them had the cultural capital, the background, the wherewithal to do the type of supplemental reading that would bring them to the truth about Birth of a Nation. So I wound up sort of getting into it with my teacher and some of my classmates about the fact that this was a nakedly racist film, and the fact that Canadians went to watch it in such big numbers said a lot about these Canadian audiences and Canadians, mainstream Canada's views on race in the early 20th century. But, you know, back then our history book was not going to mention that. And that, again, if you do enough research on a film like Birth of a Nation to write about it in a textbook, at some point that movie's plot and premise are going to come up. So if you do not mention them in your textbook, that's a choice. And now why are you making that choice? What do you want? What are you trying to keep us from knowing about mainstream white Canadians and racism in the early part of the 20th century? So, and again, looking back, I feel lucky, you know, that I entered that classroom with the background knowledge and the cultural capital to start that debate and start that discussion in our classroom, because otherwise you would have had one more cohort of the brightest kids in school thinking they know something about Birth of a Nation and what appealed to the Canadian audiences and really know nothing about it.
What island's your family from?
Well, you know, it's funny. Well, they're from Stony Island, south side of Chicago, right? But it's funny because, you know, for people who haven't read this book yet, and again, I hope as many of you as possible go out, read this book, you know.
It's a great read, yeah.
Point is, you can write a whole book about something and there are still some people who will read it and come right back to square one. And so when we were in Vancouver doing a book event, you know, there was a woman in the audience asking a question, and her preface to the question was that she had spent some time as a high school history teacher in a Black neighborhood in Dallas. And I had to shut her down, but she started to ask me a question about why Black kids don't use proper grammar. Now, in this book, there are two very specific intentional detours that I make to discuss African-American vernacular English as a dynamic, thriving, evolving dialect of the English language, and not just this collection of broken grammatical rules and not just slang. But people will read the whole book and still come back to the thing they thought before they read the book, which is, oh, these people don't use proper grammar. And so I have not had this yet, but I'm sure that at some point some Caribbean Canadian is going to read this whole book and then come to me and say, hey, I'm sorry, maybe I missed the part in the book, but at what point did you describe which island your parents came from? And again, my dad taught me early on, the only answer to that question is Stony Island. If you don't know what Stony Island is, maybe you're the one with no culture. And for the people just listening, Google Stony Island Avenue, Chicago, Illinois, and you'll get it.
Who's the audience for this book?
So as I write, I don't necessarily think of a broad audience. I think of just writing something that my friends are going to understand. That, to me, that helps keep the writing cleaner in the sense that I can just tell a story that sounds like me, that's authentic to me, but I don't have to like lard my writing with all these long words to try to impress people with how smart I am. Beyond that, you know, the audience for this book is people who are curious about families and how families work and how sometimes they don't work. Obviously people who either have an active interest in like Black American and Black Canadian history, or maybe who are mildly curious about it, or who weren't curious about it, but don't mind absorbing some of it along the way in this story about families. It's for people that are like curious about finding out how who they are. And one way to nudge yourself closer to finding out who you are is to read a story about how someone else found out who they are. But at the same time, like these themes about family conflict, identity, and how family history, identity overlap and intersect, like these are all bigger questions that, you know, you don't have to be from that person's ethnic group to want to explore. You know, there's a lot of sports in the story, obviously, because I'm a sports writer. Mm-hmm. If you like sports, you'll like this book. But you don't have to be a sports fan to get into this book. All the sports I get into, I also try to contextualize so that if you're not, you know, a football person, you will still understand what I'm talking about when I describe football. And obviously, like the Toronto Files and Chicago Files out there, people just live for Chicago stuff. This book's for you. It's a memoir built on really specific details, but taps into a lot of broader questions for people, again, that are curious about how we form identity, curious about how families work, about how families don't, how we trespass and how we forgive. And also music. Obviously, there's, you know, I have musicians in my family. There's a lot of music in this book. So I hope that describes who the audience is and people that like a good laugh and don't mind seeing racist bullies get punched in the face.
Yeah. If you're against comeuppance, for racists, maybe not the book for you.
Maybe not.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you. Always a pleasure. And again, to the audience, I hope some of y'all take the time to read. If you read the book, wherever you get it at, especially if you buy it online, that 5-star rating goes a long way towards teaching the algorithm that Jeff Gerbitz and I are actually really important guys.
Yes, please support us both. We're all right, you know?
Something like that.
Something like
that. Oh, yeah. And to your audience, at Morgan P. Campbell, same handle, Twitter, Instagram, Authory, which is a website for journalist nerds that archives all your work so that you don't have to. You can find me on any of those.
Yeah, I'll say this. As a guy that I don't read a lot of sports, but I always read Morgan's work for the reasons described. He ties together bigger themes. There's a bigger story, and that to me is interesting. And the what happens on the field, on the court is just sort of, or in the ring, I guess, lots of fights. Yes. Still in your career is sort of an expression of that. Thank you very much.
You
I appreciate you.
Appreciate you too. See you at the gym.
I'll see you at the gym.
All right. Action items. Leave a rating for the Dad Strength podcast so we can get into more ears of tuned in present dads like yourself. Pick up Morgan Campbell's excellent book, My Fighting Family, Borders and Bloodlines, and the battles that made us. Subscribe to the Dad Strength newsletter, dadstrength.com/newsletter. And otherwise, take care of yourself, man. Thanks for hanging out with us today. Big thanks to my guest, Morgan Campbell. This episode of the Dad Strength podcast was produced by Jeremy Glenn. Title music by Daniel Ross. Additional music by Mike Ford.